From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dmitry Sitkovetsky grew up in one of the Soviet Union's most illustrious musical families, and he was one of the Soviet Union's most promising young violinists. But at the age of 22, he left for the West. His mother, the pianist Bela Davidovich, followed 2 years later. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Soviet emigre musician Dmitry Sitkovetsky. Also today, ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld on recording the indigenous music of the New Guinea rainforest. His work just earned him a MacArthur Award. And book critic John Leonard reviews two collections of essays about Africa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State James Baker will visit Israel next week in another attempt to put together a Middle East peace conference. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The announcement of Secretary Baker's fifth trip to the Middle East since the Gulf War came from Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy, who was speaking to the Knesset. It comes after Syrian Foreign Minister Hafez Assad sent a letter to President Bush apparently accepting American proposals to put together a peace conference. Israel has previously rejected these same proposals. Israeli officials reacted cautiously today, saying they have still not received the complete text of the Syrian letter. But Foreign Minister Levy said he hoped it meant a change in the Syrian position and that Syria was now ready to join the peace process. Levy said that in Baker's four previous trips to the region, the U.S. and Israel have reached a series of understandings on how to move the peace process forward. Israeli analysts say they now expect American pressure on Israel to make more concessions toward peace. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
There were reports of continued fighting between Croats and ethnic Serbs in eastern Croatia today, but a European Community monitoring team said it would not operate in the area. The EC team is to observe the ceasefire between the Yugoslav Federal Army and the Secessionist Republic of Slovenia. The leader of the group said the parties involved would have to change its mandate if they want to investigate the fighting in Croatia. Members of Yugoslavia's federal presidency have called for more Federal Army troops to be sent to Croatia to put down the ethnic fighting. There have already been instances of direct fighting between the army and Croatian police. The leaders of the world's most powerful industrial nations are giving top priority at the G7 Economic Summit to the stalled efforts to reform world trade. As NPR's John Idstey reports, it's hard to see much progress on the world trade talks.
Last year, leaders thought they'd given trade talks a boost by calling them the highest economic priority. But trade negotiators at the Uruguay round of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT, missed their December deadline, and they continue to be snagged on the issue of agricultural subsidies. The U.S. wants subsidies to farmers reduced by at least 75%, but the European community continues to balk. Many economists believe the expansion of world trade after World War II has been responsible for much of global economic growth since then. Secretary of the Treasury Nicholas Brady says he believes the best that can be expected from this summit on trade is another endorsement like the one made by the leaders last year. I'm John Idstey in London.
Stock prices posted a moderate gain today on Wall Street, boosted by a rise in banking stocks that came after the merger of two major banks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 10 points to close at 2,990.61. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-3 in moderate trading of 159 million shares. This is NPR News. The Bush administration has raised its estimate of the 1992 deficit by almost 25%. The Office of Management and Budget said today that the United States is expected to spend $348 billion more than it takes in the next fiscal year. That amounts to more than one-tenth of the entire outstanding national debt of $3.5 trillion. Immigration officials plan to interview two Chinese stowaways who left their country after the crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators 2 years ago. They arrived in Seattle from Hong Kong last night. From Seattle, Carol Levinson reports.
The two Chinese women reportedly arrived in Seattle aboard a cargo ship from Hong Kong. They have since been moved to a hotel where they are awaiting the arrival of an immigration officer. After interviewing the women, authorities say the Immigration and Naturalization Service will determine if the two should receive political asylum in the U.S. According to press reports, the women participated in pro-democracy demonstrations in Beijing 2 years ago, during which hundreds of protesters were killed. The women, both students, apparently fled to Hong Kong, where one of them reportedly helped other students get out of Beijing. An immigration attorney in Seattle says there are about a dozen Chinese protesters in jail in Washington state who are still trying to win political asylum, fearing they will be persecuted if they return home. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
A New Jersey official said today that the state will take control of Mutual Benefit Life Insurance Company in an effort to head off what could be the biggest insurance failure in U.S. history. Mutual Benefit, based in Newark, is the 18th largest insurance company in the country. The company's board met today with state regulators and was expected to vote to turn the company over to the state. Industry experts expressed the concern that the takeover will erode consumer confidence in the nation's insurance companies. The state takeover would affect about 400,000 policyholders nationwide. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dmitry Sitkovetsky, grew up in the Soviet Union, where he was one of their most promising young violinists. And he was from one of the most prominent musical families in the Soviet Union. His late father was the violinist Julian Sitkovetsky. His mother is the pianist Bela Davidovich, who for 16 years was a soloist with the Leningrad Philharmonic. In 1976, at the age of 22, Dmitry left the Soviet Union for the United States. His mother followed 2 years later. They've both established themselves as important musicians in the West, as soloists and as a duo. In 1988, Dmitry performed in the Soviet Union by official invitation of the Soviet government. He was the first Soviet emigre violinist since World War II to perform in the USSR. Before we meet him, let's hear an excerpt from his most recent recording. This is the Allegro from Dmitry Shostakovich's Violin Concerto No. 2 in C-sharp minor, with Andrew Davis conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Have any plans to go back to the Soviet Union this year?
This year, I don't have any immediate plans to go back because the situation is there is rather changing almost daily, and everything seems very difficult to arrange in practical matters. I mean, they can't guarantee any, you know, hotels or any kind of arrangement that were done when I was there twice before. But so at the moment, it's kind of wait and see. Period, you know, what happens there. But if it settles down one way or the other, I might go back. Usually the time when I go there is between Christmas and New Year, around that time.
Have any concerts been getting postponed, canceled?
Oh, yes, a lot, quite a bit, because there were a number of tours were going to take place, and they simply cannot manage now anything because they never had enough hotels and any kind of facilities that way. And now, of course, everyone who'd gone to Russia since I was there last, which just a little over a year ago, they keep telling me that the situation is really almost unmanageable, and it's very, very difficult to tour that country right now.
Why do you think the Soviet government invited you back in December of '88 to perform?
I think what happened was that somewhere in the middle through that perestroika and glasnost process, They figured that the emigres living in the West were actually an asset rather than, somebody to ignore, which they did for a number of years, all of us. They at the beginning, you know, whoever left, Mstislav Rostropovich, Baryshnikov, my mother, Bela Davidovich, they simply erased our names from the books, you know, from the history of this Soviet musical life. And at some point, you know, towards the end of 80s, they figured that that was not very intelligent, because it's much better to welcome, most of us, the ones who are fairly well-known in the West and, you know, did well in immigration, and, invite them back and just be the big guys, you know, sort of say, listen, you've left, but you've carried the torch of Soviet art, of Russian art, and so to speak, you know, and carried it all through the world. And now we welcome you home and come and play now for your own people and so forth. So I think that was basically a change in policy, though I don't think at that point it happened, you know, sort of as a decision that was made and then implemented everywhere. Because by the time I came to Russia, which was the end of 88, things were already getting chaotic.
Now, I know your late father was one of the Soviet Union's foremost violinists, your mother one of the foremost pianists. Did they encourage you to start playing when you were really young, or did you pick that up on your own?
I really almost didn't have a choice but to become a musician. The only choice I had was between the violin and the piano, because in my family, I happen to be the fourth generation of professional musicians. You see, my mother's grandfather even was a professional musician. He was actually a violinist. He was a concertmaster of the Baku Opera House. And my father's family, all string players. And my mother's side, outside of that great-grandfather of mine, they were all pianists. So really, it was just a sort of a, you know, I was in the middle of all of that, and I really didn't have much of a choice. Not that I regretted it much later on, though I had my doubts at some point.
Well, if your choice was between violin or piano, how did it end up being the violin that you played?
Well, I think the choice was made for me at that point, because I was given, a violin when I was, I suppose, 4 and a half. And they took me to a wonderful pedagogue, Yuri Yankelevich, who taught many of very distinguished Russian violinists. And he in turn, gave me, for 6 months to his assistant. And he said, well, let's get him started, and in 6 months I'll tell you whether he'd be, you know, he'd have a chance. And then at the same time, I was taken to a piano teacher who taught Vladimir Ashkenazy. And she was ready to take me to her class without sort of any kind of a waiting period. But 6 months later, that pedagogue, Yuri Yankelevich, he insisted that I should study violin. And he felt that I had some kind of promise. And, you know, and then, of course, family's wish was very much for me to take up the violin rather than the piano, because by that time my father was already no longer alive. And so to sort of carry the torch of the family, I was sort of destined to be.
How old were you when your father died?
I was 3 and a half.
Oh, you were that young.
Right.
You know, it must have been kind of rough to be really young and have teachers appraising you to see, does he have it or not? Will he make it or not?
I'll tell you, that was probably at 4 and a half was not as tough as later on, because they were constantly comparing me to my father and expecting me to walk on water at the age of whatever, you know. They were expecting me to be nothing short of child prodigy, and that's a lot of pressure to put on a little boy growing up. So that was very much a rat race in that respect, and it sort of came with the territory. On one hand, we had this fantastic tradition of the best possible violin school or string school in the world, and the best schools and everything. Free education, what have you. On the other hand, it was very, very competitive.
Did that competition and pressure ever overshadow your love of the music?
Not my love of the music, but my love of violin. Yes, sometimes I did. And sort of my mid-teens, you know, sort of 13 to 15, 16, I was not a very happy individual because I just thought that, you know, it really isn't worth the effort because, you know, everybody expected me to, you know, you can ask any child who followed, you know, a parent who played the same instrument or did the same thing. I'm sure it's the same in the, you know, in the acting profession. And the answer will always be, you know, it's tremendous pressure. And having my father, who was by that time, you know, who was not playing, he was a legend in Russia, and there were only records left and, you know, memories. And so I could never really live up to those expectations. So when I did leave Russia in 77, I left behind a lot of that as well.
My guest is Soviet emigre violinist Dmitry Sitkovetsky. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Violinist Dmitry Sitkovetsky is my guest. When did you start to think about leaving the Soviet Union?
I would say probably early 70s, because they began to allow immigration mostly of the Jewish people, Soviet Jews from Russia via Israel, or to Israel or via Israel to other places. So that really started in 72, 73. So, you know, number of my friends or colleagues or acquaintances began to leave the country, and it sort of, you know, registers in your mind and you begin to take notice and think about it. And then, of course, in 75, I came out for the first time to the West and sort of saw it for myself, what that was like, and that certainly made an impression. And then by that time, by 76, I think I probably made up my mind already, and it took about a year and a half for me to complete that.
Was it hard for you to get permission to emigrate?
Yes. Yes, in terms of it was a very involved process. And since I was known, you know, most of my professional life in Russia because of my parents and then probably a little bit because of my own activities, there was very little chance that they would just simply let me go if I say, well, I'm leaving for Israel, goodbye.
Because it would make them look bad. Like, if this was such a good place to live, why would he want to leave?
Right. And also, you know, I was, you know, one of the hopeful talents that were trained to bring in, you know, fame and glory for the Soviet art as well mm-hmm. as hard currency from the West.
Right.
And, you know, they've invested with their free education and so whatnot in me, and all of a sudden I'm just leaving, you know. So They wouldn't have been too happy about it. So my plan was to, in a way, to mislead them, to make them believe that I was no longer valuable to them as an asset.
How'd you do that?
I
play a lot of clinkers.
No, I didn't do that. I just didn't play at all. I stopped playing for about a year and a half. I didn't play a note in public. And I actually went to a hospital to, you know, to do a series of tests, and so the rumor was that I was, you know, I had some kind of a special tendonitis that which enabled me, you know, which more or less made playing the violin impossible. And because I wasn't playing any public concerts, nobody could check whether I practiced or not. You know, made them believe that I was pretty much finished. Then I applied to leave. And then they thought that I was just sort of being desperate and trying maybe to find the cure in the West, which indeed I did.
Well, did you really have a problem, or did you imagine? Was this problem purely to lead them astray?
It was, you know, 90% of it is just to lead them astray.
And 10%?
10%, you know, every string player could have a potential problem with the tendonitis because of a very unnatural way you hold a violin. So, I mean, there was a certain, you know, at some point years ago I had some a little bit of a history of having these problems. I mean, almost every string player does or did at some point. So, I mean, it was based on something. But the expertise that I've gotten from the doctors was certainly a friendly gesture on that part rather than the real state of affairs.
So the doctors were in on this?
Yeah.
You know, you said no one would know whether you were practicing or not. I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that, since my understanding is that everybody in the Soviet Union at that time was always afraid of being bugged by the KGB.
Right, but you see, I didn't have to practice at my own house, or at the house, at the apartment where I lived. I had a lot of relatives and friends where, you know, I could go. I went actually to the South. And rented a place there where I practiced, and there I don't think I was being, you know, under surveillance all the whole time. I wasn't really a dissident or anything, you know. I don't think they would investigate up to a point, but they couldn't watch every single move of everybody. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration.
So when you got to the States and you started studying and then performing, did the Soviet authorities feel that they were duped, and was that ever taken out on your mother, the pianist Bela Davidovich, who remained in the Soviet Union?
Right. They did take it out on her, because at first they thought that, you know, wasn't she wonderful? You know, I was leaving Russia and, you know, sort of an outcast, and she was staying. And when I made a decision, when I applied to leave, she was summoned to the, you know, to the head of Moscow Conservatory at that time, and he had a talk with her and said, well, listen, what's going to happen now? I mean, he's leaving now, and wouldn't you be following him? And she said, well, I have no plans like that. I hope to continue my life as it was before. I hope to continue my concerts in the Soviet Union as well as outside. I will continue teaching in Moscow Conservatory, because she was a professor there. And he was pretty much reassured, and, you know, she was looked at as somebody, you know, to respect. Well, the son made a decision. Well, that's sort of bad seed of the family. But, you know, she's still the Soviet artist with all the attributes. And then it would have been maybe like that for a while. But, you know, they didn't coordinate all their efforts. And whoever it was, KGB or the Ministry of Culture or whoever, they, at the last minute, they wouldn't let her go to just about the next trip, or within 6 months, that she was going to have concerts in.
So so your mother was kind of punished for your emigration.
She was. She was. Certainly. They certainly curtailed her activities. I mean, they stopped her tours abroad and within the Soviet Union. Once that happens, you sort of become, you know, some kind of a leper, you know, culturally. And so people begin to look the other way, and you lose, you know, a lot of your contacts and personal, you know, favors that are usually done to you, you know, no longer available. So within, you know, next few months, she made a decision to leave, more or less as a result of that.
Was it hard for her to leave?
It certainly was much harder than for me, because she left, you know, so much more behind her. She was almost 50 years old when she left. And she certainly had a long and very successful career in the Soviet Union. And, you know, it was not easy for her to leave. For me, it was easier, because I left young and, you know, sort of didn't have that much to lose. But she certainly did. It was harder. It was more risky for her to leave. Fortunately, it turned out to be a success story on this side. But it certainly was very scary for her to leave at that time.
Did the authorities make it difficult for her to leave?
No, not once she applied. They sort of understood, and, you know, she already had her son over here. And if they did try to stop her, you know, from leaving, I was all ready to raise hell on this side. So they didn't really try.
So it must have been interesting, you know, a mother and son, very famous in the Soviet Union, now in the United States, where they were known but not nearly as well known as they had been in their home country. That must have had things that you appreciated about it, and things probably that you really missed about the notoriety that you had in the Soviet Union, the appreciation that you had in the Soviet Union.
Right. Especially, you know, in the case of my mother, and certainly the circle of friends and the support system that one does get, you know, once you're on a certain level. Of course, that was totally missing, and it was a completely different ballgame, so to speak. The mechanics of a career are different here. The relationships between, the managers and the artists, also the orchestras or the conductors and the soloists are different here. So all of that we sort of had to learn on our own and separately, quite separately, because I'd been here already for almost 2 years, and I was in my last year at the Juilliard School when my mother arrived. And then I went on to Europe, and I based my career and my life, really, since last 10 years in Europe. But my mother stayed here in New York, and, she was waiting for that debut at Carnegie Hall in October 79. And that was the beginning of her career in the West. And in America, in October 79, it's funny because just the month before, in September 79, I won my last competition in Vienna, the Chrysler competition, and that was the beginning of my European career. So we sort of started almost practically at the same time, but on different sides of Atlantic. And so each one had to learn, how to go about the Western career on our own. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when I came to the States in 77, hardly anyone really knew about my father or my mother, and they certainly didn't know anything about me. So that was, in a way, a blessing more than a curse in my case, because I really had to prove to myself what I was worth, as an individual rather than a dynasty, a member of a famous family.
And I guess people in America weren't always comparing you to your celebrated parents, because your parents' work wasn't as well known here.
Absolutely. And that was an advantage as far as I was concerned. I mean, I was just building something from scratch and actually welcomed that, having had the pressure that I described earlier, growing up under the shadow. There was no shadow. There was a tremendous competition otherwise, but, that could be healthy, but, shadows could be dangerous.
Well, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Violinist Dmitri Sitkovetsky. Here he is performing with his mother, pianist Bela Davidovich. This is Brahms' Violin Sonata in G Major. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Stephen Feld says when we cut down a rainforest, we don't just lose precious natural resources and a complex ecosystem, we often lose a whole culture. Feld is an ethnomusicologist who studies and records the music of the New Guinea rainforest. Coming up, Feld plays us the music of the rainforest by a people whose way of life is threatened. Also, book critic John Leonard examines how two Western writers view Africa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says that Syrian acceptance of a U.S. proposal in the Middle East is a breakthrough in efforts to put together a Middle Eastern peace settlement. Speaking to reporters in London this evening, Mr. Bush said that this is a breakthrough from what is known about it. Earlier today, it was announced that Secretary of State James Baker is heading back to the Middle East this week in new efforts to arrange peace talks there. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports from London.
Baker will try to revive the administration's efforts to broker a peace settlement between Israel and the Arab states. Instead of accompanying the president to Greece and Turkey as planned, Baker will fly to Syria on Wednesday, following the conclusion of the G7 summit here in London. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater.
The president and the secretary are hopeful that progress can be made and feel that it could be very useful for the secretary to meet again with the leaders in the region.
Earlier, Fitzwater praised a letter to the U.S. from Syrian President Hafez Assad as opening new possibilities. Baker will also travel to Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. He wraps up the trip in Israel, where he meets with Foreign Minister David Levy on Monday. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in London.
Officials in Iraq say that the country is taking steps to defend itself against the possibility of U.S. military strikes on its nuclear sites. At the same time, Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein said that he is cooperating with U.N. nuclear inspections as called for by U.N. resolutions. The Iraqi president has proposed independent inspections by either the Arab League or Egypt. Britain has now joined the United States and France in saying it is prepared to use force to stop Iraq from getting nuclear weapons. A team of observers from the European Community has arrived in Yugoslavia to monitor the implementation of a ceasefire plan for the nation. But the prospects for peace are clouded by continued violence and confusion over the EC team's mission. NPR's Tom Jelton has more.
The chairman of the EC delegation, Jo van der Valk, said upon his arrival here today that the mandate of his group is limited to the situation in Slovenia, where there was a short war between the Yugoslav army and Slovene defense forces. Fighting between Croats and Serbs in Croatia is beyond the scope of the EC team, Mr. van der Valk said. The ceasefire plan to be monitored by the EC team was worked out at a meeting on the island of Brioni last week, and the Brioni agreement does focus on Slovenia. But Croatian officials insist they were assured by the EC officials that observers would monitor the situation in Croatia as well, especially since the violence here now overshadows the conflict in Slovenia. In the last week, there have been a variety of violent clashes, the most recent yesterday and this morning in a Serbian enclave about 40 miles south of here. I'm Tom Jelton in Zagreb.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up. This is NPR News. In a move that will most likely cost cities and states millions of federal dollars, the Bush administration has refused to correct the disputed 1990 census by not changing to a population estimate. It's believed that some 5 million people will not be included in the count. A federal court had ordered Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher to decide if population estimates were more accurate than the census. The secretary said that he does not find the evidence convincing that a population estimate would improve matters, and to adjust the count would abandon a 200-year-long tradition of how people are counted. Several big cities and states have said that they will go back to court. About 8,000 state workers in California missed paychecks today because of a lingering budget standoff between Republican Governor Pete Wilson and the democratically controlled state legislature. Steve Scott of CalNet Public Radio reports from Sacramento.
The 8,000 employees, about 4% of the total state workforce, aren't getting paid because Governor Pete Wilson still hasn't signed the state's $55 billion budget. The reason for the delay is Wilson's refusal to go along with an income tax increase on the wealthy that would close the last $2 billion of what was a $14 billion deficit. Wilson says he'll agree to the tax hike, but only if it's tied to workers' compensation reform. In addition to holding up paychecks, the impasse has also delayed state payments for health, welfare, and local courts. Ironically, the deadlock continues even as a record sales tax increase designed to close the deficit goes into effect. Wilson has until Tuesday midnight to act on the budget. For National Public Radio, this is Steve Scott in Sacramento.
And the government says that industrial production continued to move up last month, gaining 0.7%. Production has been climbing at an annual rate of 1.7% since March. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Environmentalists have made us aware of how precious the disappearing rainforest is. Stephen Feld has found something precious in the rainforest that environmentalists don't usually mention, music. Since the mid-70s, Feld has been studying and recording the music of the Kalali people in the Bonsavi rainforest of Papua New Guinea. He's made 4 trips there over the past 15 years. His original research just earned him a MacArthur Award, commonly referred to as the Genius Award. Feld is an ethnomusicologist, and his recordings of Kalali song have been available to fellow academics. But now the rest of us can hear this music. Some of his recent recordings have been released on compact disc by a world music label run by Mickey Hart, who was a drummer with the Grateful Dead. Feld's new record, Voices of the Rainforest, shows a day in the life of the Kalali people. Before we hear the songs of the people, let's hear Feld's recording of the sounds of the rainforest itself. That the Kalali people think of themselves as voices in the forest. What do they mean by that?
It means that they're not distinct from the world of sound that they live in. It means that they sing with the birds, they sing with the insects, they sing with the water, and when they sing along with them, they try and sing like them. They're inspired by them, but they're also part of the same musical soundscape. They're not distinct from them, either spiritually or musically.
They even have a word, don't they, for this kind of multi-tracking of sounds that goes on naturally in the rainforest.
Right. This is the term they use to refer to all music, whether it's the music of nature or the nature of their own music, and it's duluguganalan, which means lift up over sounding. I know that's an awkward translation, but there's no better one. It just means that every sound is dense and layered and overlapping and interlocking and alternating. That no sounds are discrete, that you hear everything in this very deeply blended way.
Well, let me play another example of what you're describing here as singing with the natural sounds. And this is a woman singing by a creek.
Right.
Talk about the kind of singing here and what's important about it.
Well, what's important about water is you can't walk for more than a few minutes in the rainforest without crossing some kind of stream. And the Bosavi people say that songs are like water. Songs flow like waterfalls. They say when they compose songs, it's like getting a waterfall in their head. So creek sides are a favorite place for composing, and they're also a favorite place for singing and thinking about songs. And this is a kind of relaxing, but they're also singing with the water. It's sort of like choosing a nice waterfall is like choosing a good Steinway. It's an activity meant to kind of enhance the aesthetic experience of the activity of composing and singing. And that's what we have here at this creek. This woman has just composed this song, and she's trying it out, and she's trying it out with a nice gurgling stream.
Let's hear some of it.
Awanu nira siya makakani. Wafi sana kula mesa sijaro. Wafunya doko mesa sijaro.
We're listening to part of Steve Fell's recording called Voices of the Rainforest, recorded among the Kalali people in Papua New Guinea. Now, since you started going there in the 1970s, things have begun to change. I think one of the big changes in that area is that oil was discovered under the rainforest. What effect is that having on the lives of the people you've been working with?
Well, potentially, this massive discovery of major oil reserves in an area about 25 miles away from the Bosavi region is going to have extraordinary consequences. It's a very major oil reserve. 150 miles of pipeline will have to be built down to the Papuan Gulf to exploit that oil. That will mean roads into the rainforest, into these remote rainforest regions. That could potentially mean logging. And we know that mining and logging are the two things that have the most dramatically intense impact on the destruction of rainforests and the destruction of the cultures that live in the rainforests. But I should say that these people have been in continuous contact with Western ideas, with government, with missionaries. Since the late 1960s, there's been a certain amount of change that's ongoing there. This is not entirely new. In these small-scale societies, we basically find that people want to change. They are very interested in cash. They're very interested in all of the material items of the outside world. They have no way of realizing that something like clear-cutting trees in the rainforest will raise the water level, which will increase the incidence of malaria and really be a major health hazard, could destroy their gardens, and so forth. But when outside concerns come in and say, gee, we'd like to pay you a lot of cash for these trees, people in rainforest regions have no way of knowing what kind of impact this is really going to have on their lives.
My guest is ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld is my guest. What are some of the changes you've seen already in the years that you've been going back to this part of the world?
Well, with the impact of evangelical missionization, which began in the early 1970s, one of the extraordinary impacts has been the end of the ceremonial life of these people. The missionaries found all the costumes, the dramatic and emotional displays of the people, the drumming, their all-night-long song ceremonies, their tradition of spirit mediumship and shamanic performances. They found all of these things terribly suspect and did everything possible to encourage people to destroy or burn all of the artifacts associated with these ceremonies and to cease the performance of the ceremonies.
Well, you actually have a recording of one of the song ceremonies on your new CD. When did you record this? You did it before people stopped performing
right.
It.
Yes, people stopped performing these ceremonies in the mid-1980s, and they have not been revived since. So this was recorded earlier in the 1980s. It's the only track on the CD that was not recorded in 1990.
Before we hear an excerpt of this, tell us something about it. And this is a song that is very sad. I mean, even if you don't know what the lyrics are about, you can hear by the singing
right
how sad it is.
Well, one of the extraordinary things about these ceremonies that were traditionally performed is that the purpose of the songs was to make members of the audience cry. Guests would compose songs intended to make the hosts think of their deceased relatives or think of their former longhouses or places which had very deep emotional resonances or attachments for them. When they would hear those songs, they would burst out in tears, and then they would become so overcome with the grief of the songs that they would grab resin torches and scar the back of the dancer and singer who had composed that song as a way of acknowledging the power of the song.
Let's hear some of a song from a song ceremony.
Yeah.
Is that sobbing that we're hearing part of the song, or is that one of the listeners' responses to the sadness of the song?
That's a listener's response to the sadness of the song. What you're hearing there are two costume dancers dancing up and down. The rattling sound is crayfish claw rattles in their costumes. And they are singing in this echoed, lift-up, oversounding, overlapping way. And they hardly get into the song at all before a man is just totally overcome with tears of grief and anguish. 20 years ago, his brothers left this area for a labor contract. They were among the first to leave this area, and they never came back. And so the text of that song sings the names of places from the faraway world. He thought of his brothers and was overcome with deep sadness over the loss of those brothers, and that's what moved him to such a profound crying response.
I want to get back to the missionaries. You said that the missionaries were very disturbed by some of the ceremonies they saw and did their best to convince, with some success, to convince the Kalali to stop performing the ceremonies. And the song ceremony is an example of something that no longer exists. Did they think this scarring part of the ceremony was barbaric?
Yes, they thought that that was brutal. They didn't understand the evocation and the pathos and the dramaturgy of these ceremonies. They also didn't understand why they were important to the people. And the missionaries came to replace Kalali culture with a version of evangelical Christianity, which is of their own devising.
Did you participate in that dialogue at all between the missionaries and the Kalali people?
I've been participating in it in an ongoing way, but it's a very complex dialogue. The missionaries in this area like to say, we're missionaries, we're not theologians. They are not there to discuss the intellectual, artistic merits of Kalali culture with an anthropologist. They're there to change the people and to provide them with alternatives. It also should be said that many of the mission activities are really undertaken by evangelized Papuans who come into these areas and in many cases are much more zealous than the expatriate European missionaries.
You've got to ask yourself, though, I'm sure, if it's your position to try to stand in the way of change, whether that change is the pipeline through the rainforest or missionaries trying to convert the people of the culture. I mean, I think, do you ever ask yourself, do you have a vested interest almost in keeping things the way they are because it's the people who you've studied, you probably don't want to see them change? And I think there's a typical thing that people who study folklore are involved in, too, that they want to preserve things the way they are, even when certain people from that culture want to see things change.
Well, I accept change as an inevitable feature of cultural and biological life. Certainly, it's been going on in Papua New Guinea for 30,000 years, and the people were always dynamically involved in some kind of change. What I'm really concerned with is survival. I think that it's very clear that there's a relationship between environmental destruction and cultural destruction. We don't question this so much among biologists or zoologists. When they say we're losing 15,000 to 20,000 species of plants and animals a year, when they say we're losing 35,000 acres of rainforest a year, when they talk about endangered species, we don't question them. But why shouldn't we be talking about endangered music? How many songs have been lost this year? How many myths? How many instruments? How much intellectual diversity on the planet is going with this destruction of plant and animal diversity? So I feel that there's a need to see cultural and ecological survival as very connected issues. And this recording is meant to dramatize the extraordinary sound world of the rainforest and this kind of interplay of environmental sound and musical creativity, and through that to ask the question about how the survival of art and the survival of the environment are linked.
Steve, can you choose something that we haven't already played from your CD Voices of the Rainforest and introduce it to us?
How about number 5, the bamboo jew's harp? And what's interesting about it is that the man is playing duet with crickets, and he's playing a duet with the birds around him, and this is another idea of lift up over sounding. You take the sounds around you, and you imitate them, and you become part of them by playing a duet with them, and you'll hear that there's a kind of cross rhythm of the pulsing crickets in the environment and the twanging rhythm of the bamboo jew's harp in the player's mouth.
Steve Fell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen Feld's CD, Voices of the Rainforest, is on Ryko Disc. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Secretary of State James Baker, it is said, will go back to the Middle East to try to get the peace process started again between the Arab states and Israel. He'll be leaving Washington on Thursday. After a 3-month occupation, today the Allied troops have left northern Iraq. Troops crossing over into Turkey. This is the end of Operation Provide Comfort, which at one time involved more than 21,000 Allied troops. Deborah Wong will report from the border there. And I'll be talking with Crystal Waters, 27-year-old singer, with a record that's been number one on the Billboard dance charts. It's called Gypsy Woman, a song about a homeless woman in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Africa has always been a subject of fascination for Western writers. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of 2 new books about the continent by American authors. Maneater's Motel is by Dennis Boyles. African Silences is by Peter Matheson, who's probably best known for his books about American social movements and the natural and spiritual worlds.
Peter Matheson has been to Africa before, in The Tree Where Man Was Born. These essays from 2 decades take him back, by boat, train, jeep, plane, and sore feet, from Kenya and Tanzania in the east to Cameroon, Senegal, and the Ivory Coast in the west, with Uganda and Zaire in between. This is a lot of bush pigs, buffaloes, and baboons, not to mention swamp antelope and palm nut vultures, Congo peacocks and Abyssinian hornbills, many pygmies, and one plimpton, George, a friend of his. The elephants are dying, and so are the rhinos, and a mongoose goes after Matheson while he's trying to take a shower. And there are brand new things to be said about Diane Fossey, AIDS, poaching, dictatorship, and the Serengeti. All these things are said, as we've come to expect from Matheson, in a high style of brilliant hues, but also with a mournfulness. Not just the elephants, but all of Africa is dying. Dennis Boyles, a contributing editor to Playboy, is much breezier in East Africa, whose history, he tells us, has been so thoroughly romanticized for Westerners that it now seems like a sequence of fables, a collection of anthrofiction, a mythology involving a long pre-colonial golden age in which gentle pastoral tribesmen watched their flocks as mystics studied the heavens and visionaries built mysterious cities. Boyles disdains this romance of a golden age, rudely interrupted first by roving gangs of white chaps who overpowered local chiefs, then kidnapped millions of natives and took them to Louisiana and elsewhere. There was slavery in Africa before there were white men, he says, and he doesn't particularly esteem the blacks he meets on a train from Mombasa to Lake Victoria. On the other hand, he's no kinder to white people either. Poor Isaac Dennison gets hers, the precious, affected, patronizing, self-absorbed Dane, he describes her, who was more concerned about her aristocratic title than almost anything else in her life. Boyles would rather tell us very funny anecdotes, especially about man-eating lions, to whom he devotes an hilarious appendix. I'm probably being unfair to both these books, but it does seem to me the time's come for white people to shut up about black Africa, especially since we no longer want to invest in all these new nations now that the Cold War is over and there's nothing in it for us except exotic material for morbid lamentation. We ought to be sending food instead of writers. Graham Greene and Joseph Conrad, Evelyn Waugh and Ernest Hemingway, Saul Bellow and John Updike, the Dark Continent has been a Rorschach test for white writers with wounds in their manhood. Why not listen for a while? Not necessarily to the pelicans and storks or the green monkeys and the armored beetles, but to African writers themselves, novelists like Chinua Achebe and Nerudin Farah, playwrights and essayists like Wole Soyinka. We've long since learned to let the Latin Americans tell us all about themselves, and the Russians and the Japanese, and the Irish and the Indians. Our problem with Africa, as with Arabia, is that we're still tourists, on safari, bagging snap impressions, picture postcards of despair.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed African Silences by Peter Matheson and Maneater's Motel by Dennis Boyles. We want to hear your comments about Fresh Air, so we have a new toll-free listener response line. Give us a call at 1-800-NPR-WHYY and let us know what you're thinking. Instead of talking to your radio, tell us directly, 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This summer, phone systems in several states experienced massive failures because of problems with computer software. On the next Fresh Air, the predicament of our computer-dependent society. We talk with Leonard Lee, author of the new book, The Day the Phone Stopped, The Computer Crisis. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.